with a test pattern that ran for a few hours and showed a few shows broadcast out of New York or Hollywood, and then went off around 7 or 8. There wasn't much to watch. It was all small-town stuff, very narrow, provincial, where everybody actually knows everyone. Now at last I was in Minneapolis, where I felt liberated and gone, never meaning to go back. I'd come into Minneapolis unnoticed. I rode in on a Greyhound bus. Nobody was there to greet me, and nobody knew me, and I liked it that way. My mother had given me an address for a fraternity house on University Avenue. My cousin Chucky, whom I just slightly knew, had been the fraternity president. My mom said that she talked to my aunt about calling Chucky and letting me stay there, at least while the place was vacated during the summer and most of its members were gone. There were a couple of guys hanging around when I got there, and one of them said that I could stay in one of the upstairs rooms, the one at the end of the hall. It was a nothing room with just a bunk bed and a table by the window without any curtains. I set my bags down and gazed out the window. I suppose what I was looking for was what I read about in On the Road. Looking for the great city. Looking for the speed, the sound of it. Looking for what Allen Ginsberg had called the hydrogen jukebox world. Lawrence Ferlinghetti, one of the other beat poets, had called it the kiss-proof world of plastic toilet seats, Tampax, and taxis. Creatively, you couldn't do much with it. I had already landed in a parallel universe anyway, with more archaic principles and values, one where actions and virtues were old-style and judgmental things came falling out of their heads. A culture with outlaw women, super-thugs, demon lovers, and gospel truths, streets and valleys, rich peaty swamps with landowners and oilmen, Staggerlees, Pretty Pollys, and John Henrys, an invisible world that towered overhead with walls of gleaming corridors. It was all there and it was clear, ideal and God-fearing. But you had to go find it. It didn't come served on a paper plate. Folk music was a reality of a more brilliant dimension. It was so real, so more true to life than life itself. It was life magnified. Folk music was all I needed to exist. Trouble was, there wasn't enough of it. It was out of date, had no proper connection to actualities, the trends of the time. It was a huge story, but hard to come across. Once I'd slipped in beyond the fringes, it was like my 6-string guitar became a crystal magic wand and I could move things like never before. I had no other cares or interests besides folk music. I scheduled my life around it. I had little in common with anyone not like-minded. I gazed out the second-story window of the fraternity house overlooking University Avenue through the green elm trees and slow-moving traffic, low-hanging clouds. The birds were singing. It was like a curtain was being lifted. It was early June and a fine spring day. I could easily come and go and nobody would bother me here. First thing I did was go trade in my electric guitar, which would have been useless to me, for a 00 Martin acoustic. I would play this guitar for the next couple of years or so. The area around the university was known as Dinkytown, which was kind of like a little village, untypical from the rest of conventional Minneapolis. I found the local record store in the heart of Dinkytown. What I was looking for were folk music records, and the first one I saw was Odetta on the Tradition label. I went into the listening booth to hear it. Odetta was great. I had never heard of her until then. She was a deep singer, powerful strumming and a hammering-on style of playing. I learned almost every song off the record right then and there, even borrowing the hammering-on style. With my newly learned repertoire, I went further up the street and dropped into the 10 o'clock Scholar, a beat coffee house. I was looking for players with kindred pursuits. The first guy I met in Minneapolis like me was sitting around in there. It was John Kerner, and he also had an acoustic guitar with him. Kerner was tall and thin with a look of perpetual amusement on his face. We hit it off right away. We already knew a few of the same songs, like Wabash Cannonball and Waiting for a Train. Kerner had just gotten out of the Marine Corps and was an aeronautical engineering student. We sat around and I played my Odetta songs and a few by Leadbelly. Kerner was an exciting singer and we began playing a lot together. I learned a lot of songs off Kerner by singing harmony with him, and he had folk records of performers I'd never heard at his apartment. I listened to them a lot, especially to the New Lost City Ramblers. I took to them immediately. Everything about them appealed to me, their style, their singing, their sound. I liked the way they looked, the way they dressed, and I especially liked their name. Their songs ran the gamut in styles, everything from mountain ballads to fiddle tunes and railroad blues. All their songs vibrated with some dizzy, pretentious truth. I'd stay with the Ramblers for days. For me, they had originality in spades, were men of mystery on all counts. Kerner had some other key records, too, mostly on the Folkways label. Fo'c'sle Songs and Sea Shanties was one that I could listen to over and over again. This one featured Dave Van Ronk, Roger Abrams, and some others. The record knocked me out. It was full ensemble singing. Hard-driving harmonic songs like Holloway Joe, Hangin' Johnny, Radcliffe Highway. Sometimes Kerner and I sang some of those songs as a duo. Another record he had was the Electra Folk Song Sampler, with a variety of artists. That's where I first heard Dave Van Ronk and Peggy Seeger. I listened a lot to a John Jacob Niles record, too. Niles was non-traditional, but he sang traditional songs. A Mephistophelian character out of Carolina, he hammered away at some harp-like instrument and sang in a bone-chilling soprano voice. Niles was eerie and illogical, terrifically intense and gave you goosebumps. Definitely a switched-on character, almost like a sorcerer. Kerner said that I had to meet a guy named Harry Weber, and through him I did. Weber was an English literary professor, a tweed-wearing, old-fashioned intellectual, and he did know plenty of songs, mostly roving ballads, stern ballads, ones that meant cruel business. I learned one called Old Greybeard, about a young girl whose mother tells her to go kiss a man who has been arranged for her to marry, and the daughter tells the mother to go kiss him herself, that the old gray beard is now clean-shaven. I loved all these ballads right away. They were romantic as all hell and high above all the popular love songs I'd ever heard. Lyrically, they worked on some kind of supernatural level, and they made their own sense. I used to sing another one, too, called When a Man's in Love. Where a boy in love feels no cold, he'll go through frosted snow to meet his girl, get her and take her to some silent place. I was beginning to feel like a character from within these songs, even beginning to think like one. I could rattle off all these songs without comment, as if all the wise and poetic words were mine and mine alone. The songs had beautiful melodies, and were filled with everyday leading players like barbers and servants, mistresses and soldiers, sailors, farmhands and factory girls, their comings and goings. When they spoke in the songs, they entered your life. But there was more to it than that, a lot more. Beneath it, I was into the rural blues as well. It was a counterpart of myself. Highway 61, the main thoroughfare of the country blues, begins about where I came from, Duluth to be exact. I always felt like I'd started on it, always been on it, and could go anywhere from it, even down into the deep Delta country. It was the same road, full of the same contradictions, the same one-horse towns, the same spiritual ancestors. The Mississippi River, the bloodstream of the blues, also starts up from my neck of the woods. I was never too far away from any of it. It was my place in the universe. Always felt like it was in my blood. Kerner and I were playing and singing a lot together as a duo, but we each did our own thing separately. As for myself, I played morning, noon, and night. That's all I did, usually fell asleep with the guitar in my hands. I went through the entire summer this way. In the fall, I was sitting at the lunch counter in Gray's Drugstore. Gray's Drugstore was in the heart of Dinkytown. I had moved into a room right above it. School was back in session, and university life was picking up again. My cousin Chucky and his buddies had all moved away from the fraternity house, and the fraternity members, or would-be fraternity members, soon reappeared. They asked me who I was and what I was doing there. Nothing, I wasn't doing anything there. I was sleeping there. Of course, I knew what was coming and quickly grabbed my bags and left. The room above Gray's Drugstore cost $30 a month. It was an okay place, and I could easily afford it. By this time, I was making $3 to $5 every time I played at either one of the coffee houses around or another place over in St. Paul called the Purple Onion Pizza Parlor. Above Gray's, the crash pad was no more than an empty storage room with a sink and a window looking into an alley. No closet or anything. Toilet down the hall. I put a mattress on the floor, bought a used dresser, plugged in a hot plate on top of that, used the outside window ledge as a refrigerator when it got cold. I was sitting at the counter at Gray's one day, winter had come early, wind howled across the Central Avenue Bridge outside, and a carpet of snow was beginning to form on the ground. Flo Kastner, who I'd known from one of the coffee houses, the Bastille, had come in and sat down beside me. Flo was an actress in the Drama Academy, an aspiring thespian, odd-looking but beautiful in a wacky way. Had long red hair, was light-skinned, dressed in black from head to foot. She had an uptown but folksy demeanor, was a mystic and transcendentalist, believed in the occult power of trees and things like that. She was also serious about reincarnation. We used to have strange conversations. In another life, I could have been you, she'd say. Yeah, but then I wouldn't have been the same person in that life. Yeah, that's right. Let's work on it. On this particular day, we were just sitting around talking, and she asked me if I ever heard of Woody Guthrie. I said, sure. I heard him on the Stinson Records with Sonny Terry and Cisco Houston. Then she asked me if I'd ever heard him all by himself on his own records. I couldn't remember having done that. Flo said that her brother Lynn had some of his records, and she'd take me over there to hear him. That Woody Guthrie was somebody that I should definitely get hip to. Something about this sounded important, and I became definitely interested. Lynn was at home when Flo brought me by. He said it was okay to look through his record collection, pulled out a few record albums of old 78s. One was the Spirituals to Swing concert at Carnegie Hall. This was a collection of 78s, with Count Basie, Mead Lux Lewis, Joe Turner, Pete Johnson, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, among many others. The other collection was one that Flo had told me about, a Woody Guthrie set of about 12 double-sided 78 records. I put one on the turntable, and when the needle dropped, I was stunned. Didn't know if I was stoned or straight. What I heard was Woody singing a whole lot of his own compositions all by himself. Songs like Ludlow Massacre, 1913 Massacre, Jesus Christ, Pretty Boy Floyd, Hard Travelin', This Land Is Your Land. All these songs together, one after another, made my head spin. It was like land parted. I heard Guthrie before, but mainly just a song here and there, mostly things that he sang with other artists. I hadn't actually heard him, not in this earth-shattering kind of way. I couldn't believe it. Guthrie had such a grip on things. He was so poetic and tough and rhythmic. There was so much intensity, and his voice was like a stiletto. His mannerisms, the way everything just rolled off his tongue. It all just about knocked me down. It was like the record player itself had just picked me up and flung me across the room. I was listening to his diction, too. He would throw in the sound of the last letter of a word whenever he felt like it, and it would come like a punch. Not one mediocre song in the bunch. Woody Guthrie tore everything in his path to pieces. For me, it was an epiphany, like some heavy anchor had just plunged into the waters of the harbor. That day, I listened all afternoon to Guthrie as if in a trance, and I felt like I had discovered some essence of self-command, that I was in the internal pocket of the system, feeling more like myself than ever before. A voice in my head said, "So this is the game." I could sing all these songs, every single one of them, and they were all that I wanted to sing. It was like I had been in the dark and someone had turned on the main switch of a lightning conductor. A great curiosity respecting the man had also seized me, and I had to find out who Woody Guthrie was. It didn't take me long. Dave Whitaker, one of the Svengali-type beats on the scene, happened to have Woody's autobiography, Bound for Glory, and he lent it to me. I went through it from cover to cover like a hurricane, totally focused on every word, and the book sang out to me like the radio. Woody's got a fierce poetic soul, the poet of hard crust sod and gumbo mud. Guthrie divides the world between those who work and those who don't, and is interested in the liberation of the human race and wants to create a world worth living in. Bound for Glory is a hell of a book. It's huge, almost too big. His songs are something else, though. For me, his songs made everything else come to a screeching halt. I decided then and there to sing nothing but Guthrie songs. I said to myself I was going to be Guthrie's greatest disciple. It seemed like a worthy thing. I even seemed to be related to him. Even from a distance and having never seen the man, I could perceive his face with a clearness. He looks not unlike my father in my father's early days. I knew little about Woody. I wasn't even sure if he was alive anymore. The book makes it seem like he was a character from the old past. Whitaker, though, had got me up to date on him, that he was in ill health somewhere in the East, and I pondered that. During the next few weeks, I went back a few times to listen to those records. One by one, I began singing them all, felt connected to these songs on every level. They were cosmic. One thing for sure, Woody Guthrie had never seen nor heard of me, but it felt like he was saying, "I'll be going away, but I'm leaving this job in your hands. I know I can count on you." Now that I crossed the divide, I was head over heels and singing nothing but Guthrie songs. And I was beginning to feel the phenomenal scope of Woody's songs. The Sacco and Vanzetti ballads, Dust Bowl and children's songs, Grand Coulee Dam songs, venereal disease songs, union and working men ballads, even his rugged heartbreak love ballads. Each one seemed like a towering tall building with a variety of scenarios all appropriate for different situations. Woody made each word count. He painted with words. That, along with his stylized type singing, the way he phrased, The dusty cowpoke deadpan but amazingly serious and melodic sense of delivery was like a buzzsaw in my brain, and I tried to emulate it any way I could. A lot of folks might have thought of Woody's songs as backdated, but not me. I felt they were totally in the moment, current, and even forecasting things to come. I felt anything but like the young punk folk singer who had just begun out of nowhere 6 months previously. It felt more like I had instantly risen up from a non-commissioned volunteer to an honorable knight, stripes and gold stars. Woody's songs were having that big an effect on me, an influence on every move I made, what I ate and how I dressed, who I wanted to know, who I didn't. In the late 50s and early 60s, teenage rebellion was beginning to make noise, but that scene hadn't appealed to me, not in the wholehearted way. It had no organized shape. The rebel without a cause thing wasn't hands-on enough. Even a lost cause, I thought, would be better than no cause. Singing Woody's songs, I could keep everything else at a safe distance. This fantasy was short-lived, however. Thinking that I was wearing the sharpest-looking uniform and the shiniest boots around, all of a sudden I felt a jolt and was stopped short in my tracks. It felt like someone had taken a chunk out of me. John Pancake, a folk music purist enthusiast, and sometime literary teacher and film wise man, who'd been watching me for a while on the scene, made it his business to tell me that what I was doing hadn't escaped him. "What do you think you're doing? You're singing nothing but Guthrie songs," he said, jabbing his finger into my chest like he was talking to a poor fool. Pancake was authoritative, and a hard guy to get past. He was a bit of a film critic, too. While other intellectual types might be discussing poetic differences between T.S. Eliot and E.E. Cummings, Pancake would come up with arguments about why John Wayne was a better cowboy in Rio Bravo than he was in Legend of the Lost. He expounded on directors like Howard Hawks or John Ford, that they get Wayne when other directors don't. Maybe Pancake was right, maybe not. It wasn't that big a deal. Actually, as far as Wayne goes, I'd meet the Duke in the mid-60s. He was the big male movie star at the time and was filming a war movie about Pearl Harbor in harm's way over in Hawaii. A girl I used to know in Minneapolis, Bonnie Beecher, had become an actress and was playing a supporting role. Me and my band, the Hawks, had stopped through there on our way to Australia, and she invited me down to the set, a naval battleship. She introduced me to the Duke, who was in full military uniform, an army of people surrounding him. I watched him film a scene, and then Bonnie brought me over to meet him. "I hear you're a folk singer," he said, and I nodded. "Sing something," he said. I took out my guitar and sang Buffalo Skinners, and he smiled, looked at Burgess Meredith, who was sitting in a canvas chair, then looked back at me and said, "I like that. Left that drover's bones to bleach, huh?" "Yep." He asked me if I knew Blood on the Saddle. I did know Blood on the Saddle. A little bit of it, anyway. But I knew High Noon better. I thought about singing it, and maybe if I was standing there with Gary Cooper, I would have. But Wayne wasn't Gary Cooper. I don't know if he would have liked that song. The Duke was a massive figure. He looked like a heavy piece of hauled lumber, and it didn't seem like any man could stand shoulder to shoulder with him. Not anybody in the movies, anyway. I thought of asking him why some of his cowboy films were better than others, but it would have been crazy to do that. Or maybe it wouldn't have been. I don't know. In any case, I never would have dreamed that I'd be standing there on a battleship somewhere in the Pacific singing for the great cowboy John Wayne, while back in Minneapolis face to face with John Pancake. "You're trying hard, but you'll never turn into Woody Guthrie," Pancake says to me. He made me nervous. He breathed fire through his nose. "You better think of something else. You're doing it for nothing. Jack Elliott's already been where you are and gone. Ever heard of him?" "Never heard of him, no. What does he sound like?" John said that he'd play me his records and that I was in for a surprise. Pancake lived in an apartment over Makasha's bookstore, a place that specialized in eclectic old books, ancient texts, philosophical political pamphlets from the 1800s on up. The record he took out and played for me first was Jack Takes the Floor, an imported record, a very obscure one. The record started to spin and Jack's voice blasted into the room. "San Francisco Bay Blues, Old Riley and Bedbug Blues go by in a flash. Damn, I'm thinking, this guy's really great. Sounds just like Woody Guthrie, only a leaner, meaner one. Not singing the same Guthrie songs, though. I felt like I'd been cast into a sudden hell." Jack was some master of musical tricks. The record cover was mysterious, but not in an ominous way. It showed a character with certain careless ease, rakish-looking, a handsome saddle tramp. His voice leaps all over the room in a lazy way, and he's explosive when he wants to be. Elliot, who'd been born 10 years before me, had actually traveled with Guthrie, learned his songs and style firsthand, and had mastered it completely. Pancake was right. Elliot had indeed already gone beyond Guthrie, and I was still getting there. I had nothing near the compelling poise of self that I heard on the record. I sheepishly left the apartment and went back out onto the cold street, aimlessly walked around. I felt like I had nowhere to go, felt like one of the dead men walking through catacombs. It would be hard not to be influenced by the guy I just heard. I'd have to block it out of my mind, though, forget this thing, tell myself I hadn't heard him and he didn't exist. He was overseas in Europe anyway, in self-imposed exile. The U.S. hadn't been ready for him. Good. I was hoping he'd stay gone, and I kept hunting for Guthrie songs. A few weeks later, Pancake heard me playing again and was quick to point out that I didn't fool him, that I used to be imitating Guthrie and now I was imitating Elliot. I wasn't trying to fool anybody. I was just doing what I could with what I had where I was. Pancake was right, though. You can't take only a few dance lessons then think you're Fred Astaire. The road ahead had always been encumbered with shadowy forms that had to be dealt with in one way or another. Now there was another one. I knew Jack was up there someplace, and I hadn't missed what Pancake had said about him. It was true. Jack was the king of the folk singers. The queen of the folk singers. That would have to be Joan Baez. Joan was born the same year as me, and our futures would be linked. But at this time, to even think about it would be preposterous. She had one record out on the Vanguard label called Joan Baez, and I'd seen her on TV. She'd been on a folk music program broadcast nationwide on CBS out of New York. I couldn't stop looking at her, didn't want to blink. She was wicked-looking. Shiny black hair that hung down over the curve of slender hips, drooping lashes, partly raised. No Raggedy Ann doll. The sight of her made me high. All that, and then there was her voice. A voice that drove out the bad spirits. It was like she'd come down from another planet. Both Scott and Mex, she looked like a religious icon. Like somebody you'd sacrifice yourself for, and she sang in a voice straight to God. Also was an exceptionally good instrumentalist. The Vanguard record was no phony baloney. It was almost frightening, an impeccable repertoire of songs, all hardcore traditional. She seemed very mature, seductive, intense, magical. Nothing she did didn't work. That she was the same age as me almost made me feel useless. However illogical it may have seemed, something told me that she was my counterpart, that she was the one that my voice could find perfect harmony with. There was no clue from her records that she was interested in social change or any of that. I considered her lucky, lucky to get involved with the right kind of folk music early on, get up to her eyeballs in it, learn how to play it and sing it in an expert way, beyond criticism, beyond category. When she sang, she made your teeth drop. I'd be scared to meet her. She might bury her fangs in the back of my neck. I didn't want to meet her, but I knew I would. I was going in the same direction, even though I was way in back of her at the moment. She had the fire, and I felt I had the same kind of fire. Eventually, it was time for me to get out of Minneapolis. Just like Hibbing, the Twin Cities had gotten a little too cramped, and there was only so much you could do. The world of folk music was too closed off, and the town was beginning to feel like a mud puddle. New York City was the place I wanted to be, and one snowy morning around daybreak, after sleeping in the back room of the Purple Onion Pizza Parlor in St. Paul, the place where Kerner and I played, with only a few tattered rags in a suitcase and a guitar and harmonica rack, I stood on the edge of town and hitchhiked east to find Woody Guthrie. He was still the man. It was freezing, and although I might have been slack in a lot of things, my mind was ordered and disciplined and I didn't feel the cold. Soon I was rolling through the snowy Wisconsin prairie fields. The looming shadows of Baez and Elliot were not far from my heels. The world I was heading into, although it would undergo a lot of changes, was really the world of Jack Elliot and Joan Baez. However true that might have been, I too had the axe in my hands and needed to tear out of there, head off to where life promised something more. Felt that my own voice and guitar would be equal to the situation. New York City, midwinter 1961. Whatever I was doing was working out okay and I intended to stay with it. Felt like I was closing in on something. I was playing on the regular bill at the Village Gaslight. The pay was $60 weekly cash, at least that's what it was for me. It was a huge step above the Greenwich Village basket house scene. Noel Stuckey, who later became part of Peter, Paul and Mary, was the MC. Noel was an impressionist, a comedian and a singer and a guitar player. He could imitate just about anything: clogged water pipes and toilets flushing, steamships and sawmills, traffic, violins and trombones. He could imitate singers imitating other singers. One of his more outrageous imitations was Dean Martin imitating Little Richard. Hugh Romney, who later became the psychedelic clown Wavy Gravy, also performed down there. When he was Hugh Romney, he was the straightest-looking cat you'd ever seen, always smartly dressed, usually in Brooks Brothers light gray suits. Romney was a monologist, gave long, intimate, unestablishmentarian raps, had squinty eyes you could never tell if they were closed or open. It was as if his sight was impaired. He'd walk on stage, squint into the blue spotlight, and begin talking like he had just taken a long voyage and come back from a distant realm. Len Chandler played at the Gaslight. Paul Clayton occasionally played sets down there, too. Paul got all his versions of songs by adapting transcriptions from old texts. Through Paul, I met people here and there who said to me it was okay to stay at their apartments anytime I needed it, and not to worry about it. Clayton was good friends with Van Ronk, too. Dave Van Ronk, he was the one performer I burned to learn particulars from. He was great on records, but in person he was greater. Van Ronk was from Brooklyn, had Siemens papers, a wide walrus mustache, long brown straight hair which flew down covering half his face. He turned every folk song into a surreal melodrama, a theatrical piece, suspenseful down to the last minute. Dave got to the bottom of things. It was like he had an endless supply of poison and I wanted some. Couldn't do without it. Van Ronk seemed ancient, battle-tested. Every night I felt like I was sitting at the feet of a time-worn monument. Later, when I would record my first album, half the cuts on it were renditions of songs that Van Ronk did. It's not like I planned that, it just happened. Unconsciously, I trusted his stuff more than I did mine. Van Ronk's voice was like rusted shrapnel, and he could get a lot of subtle ramifications out of it. Delicate, gentle, rough, explosive, sometimes all within the same song. He could conjure up anything, expressions of terror, expressions of despair. He also was an expert guitar player. He also showed me around the regular haunts of Greenwich Village, and I got to see a lot of the jazz greats close up. As a performer, Van Ronk did something else that I found intriguing. One of his patented dramatic effects would be to stare intently at somebody in the crowd. He'd pin their eyes like he was singing to just them, whispering some secret, telling somebody something where their lives hung in the balance. He also never phrased the same thing the same way twice. Sometimes I'd hear him play the same song that he'd done in a previous set, and it would hit me in a completely different way. If you were on McDougal Street in the evening and out to see somebody play, he'd be the first and last vital choice of the night. He towered over the street like a mountain, but would never break into the big time. It just wasn't where he pictured himself. He didn't want to give up too much. No puppet strings on him ever. He was big, sky high, and I looked up to him. He came from the land of giants. Van Ronk's wife, Terry, definitely not a minor character, took care of Dave's bookings, especially out of town, and she began trying to help me out. Mostly I stayed around in New York City. I was fortunate to have the regular gig at the Gaslight and wasn't on any wild goose chase to go anywhere. Once Terry offered to bring me over to Jock Holtzman, who operated Elektra Records, one of the companies that released some of Dave's stuff. "I can get you an appointment. Do you want to sit down with him?" "I don't want to sit down with anybody, no." The idea didn't contain too much for me. Sometime later in the summer, Terry managed to get me on a live radio folk extravaganza broadcast from Riverside Church up on Riverside Drive. Things were about to change for me again, to get new and strange. Backstage, the humidity was soaring. Performers came and went, waited to go on and milled around. As usual, the real show was backstage. I was talking to a dark-haired girl, Carla Rotolo, who I knew a little bit. Carla was Ellen Lomax's personal assistant. Carla introduced me to her sister. Her sister's name was Susie, but she spelled it S-U-Z-E. Right from the start, I couldn't take my eyes off her. She was the most erotic thing I'd ever seen. She was fair-skinned and golden-haired, full-blood Italian. The air was suddenly filled with banana leaves. We started talking and my head started to spin. Cupid's arrow had whistled by my ears before, but this time it hit me in the heart and the weight of it dragged me overboard. Susie was 17 years old, from the East Coast, had grown up in Queens, raised in a left-wing family. Her father had worked in a factory and had recently died. She was involved in the New York art scene, painted and made drawings for various publications, worked in graphic design and in off-Broadway theatrical productions, also worked on civil rights committees. She could do a lot of things. Meeting her was like stepping into the tales of 1001 Arabian Nights. She had a smile that could light up a street full of people and was extremely lively, had a particular type of voluptuousness, a Rodin sculpture come to life. She reminded me of a libertine heroine. She was just my type. For the next week or so, I thought of her a lot. Couldn't shut her out of my mind. Was hoping I'd run into her. I felt like I was in love for the first time in my life. Could feel her vibe 30 miles away. Wanted her body next to mine. Now. Right now. As fate would have it, I ran into Carla again and asked about her sister. Carla asked me if I'd like to see her. I said, yeah, you don't know how much. And she said, oh, she'd like to see you too. Soon we met up and began to see each other more and more. Eventually, we got pretty inseparable. Outside of my music, being with her seemed to be the main point in life. Maybe we were spiritual soulmates. Her mother Mary, though, who worked as a translator for medical journals, wasn't having it. Mary lived on the top floor of an apartment building on Sheridan Square and treated me like I had the clap. If she would have had her way, the cops would have locked me up. She thought I had a nameless way of life and would never be able to support anybody. But I think it went much deeper than that. I think I just came in at a bad time. How much did that guitar cost, she asked me once. Not much. I know, not much, but still something. Almost nothing, I said. She glared at me, cigarette in her mouth. Once I said to her that I didn't think she was being fair, she stared squarely into my eyes like she was staring at some distant, visible object and said to me, do me a favor. Don't think when I'm around. Susie would tell me later that she didn't mean it. She did mean it, though. She did everything in her power to keep us apart, but we went on seeing each other anyway. The stifling scene was becoming problematic, signaling to me that I needed to get my own place. But I liked staying with others. It was less of a hassle, easier, with little responsibility. Places where I could freely come and go, sometimes even with a key. Rooms with plenty of hardback books on shelves and stacks of phonograph records. When I wasn't doing anything else, I'd thumb through the books and listen to records. After being in town close to a year, I rented a third-floor walk-up apartment at 161 West 4th Street at $60 a month. It wasn't much, just two rooms above Bruno's Spaghetti Parlor, next door to the local record store and a furniture supply shop on the other side. It came empty. Quickly after moving in, I built some furniture for the place. With some borrowed tools, I made a couple of tables, one which doubled as a desk. I also put together a cabinet and a bed frame. Besides playing music, I liked doing these kinds of things. I purchased a used TV, stuck it on top of one of the cabinets, bought a mattress and got a rug that I spread across the hardwood floor. I got a record player at Woolworth's and put it on one of the tables. The small room seemed immaculate to me, and I felt that for the first time I had a place of my own. Susie and I were spending more and more time together, and I began to broaden my horizons, see a lot of what her world was like, especially the off-Broadway scene, a lot of Leroy Jones stuff, Dutchman, The Baptism. A new world of art was opening up my mind. Sometimes early in the day we'd go uptown to city museums, see giant oil-painted canvases by artists like Velazquez, Goya, Delacroix, Rubens, El Greco. Susie's favorite current modern artist was Red Grooms, and he became mine too. I loved the way everything he did crushed itself into some fragile world, the rickety clusters of parts all packed together, and then, standing back, you could see the complex whole of it. There was a connection in Red's work to a lot of the folk songs I sang. What the folk songs were lyrically, Red's works were visually. All the bums and cops, the lunatic bustle, the claustrophobic alleys, all the carny vitality. He incorporated every living thing into something and made it scream. Everything hilarious, but not jokey. All done with graphic finesse, burned out as powerful as possible. I loved the way Grooms used laughter as a diabolical weapon. Subconsciously, I was wondering if it was possible to write songs like that. About that time, I began to make my own drawings. I actually picked up the habit from Susie, who drew a lot. What would I draw? Well, I guess I would start with whatever was at hand. I sat at the table, took out a pencil and paper, and drew the typewriter, a crucifix, a rose, pencils and knives and pins, empty cigarette boxes. I'd lose track of time completely. In a strange way, I noticed that it purified the experience of my eye, and I would make drawings of my own for years to come. This was the same table that I'd sit at and compose songs. Not quite yet, though. You have to take the lead from somewhere, and there were only a few performers around who wrote songs, and of them, my favorite was Len Chandler. But I just thought that it was his own personal thing, and it wasn't enough to inspire me to do it myself. As far as I was concerned, Woody Guthrie had written the greatest songs, and there was no way to top that. Eventually, though, while not trying to reweave the world, I did compose a slightly ironic song called Let Me Die in My Footsteps. I based it on an old Roy Acuff ballad. The song I wrote was inspired by the fallout shelter craze that had blossomed out of the Cold War. I suppose some considered it radical to come up with a song like that, but to me it wasn't radical at all. In northern Minnesota, fallout shelters didn't catch on, had no effect whatsoever on the Iron Range. As far as communists went, there wasn't any paranoia about them. Mine owners were more to be feared, more of an enemy anyway. Salesmen peddling fallout shelters had been turned away. You couldn't imagine having to confront some neighbor banging on your door saying something like, "Hey look, it's a matter of life and death and our friendship ain't worth a bow diddly. Is that what you're trying to tell me?" Bomb shelters divided families and could create mutiny. Not that people weren't concerned about the mushroom cloud, they were. But salesmen hawking the bomb shelters were met with expressionless faces. Besides that, the general opinion was, in case of nuclear attack, all you really needed was a surplus Geiger counter. In fact, I even had one in my New York apartment. So writing a song about the futility of fallout shelters was not that radical. When I began performing Let Me Die in My Footsteps, I didn't even say I wrote it. I just slipped it in somewhere, said it was a Weaver's song. My perspective on all that was about to change. The air would soon shoot up in intensity and become more potent. My little shack in the universe was about to expand into some glorious cathedral, at least in songwriting terms. Susie had been working behind the scenes in a musical production at the Theater de Lille on Christopher Street. It was a presentation of songs written by Bertolt Brecht, the anti-fascist Marxist German poet-playwright whose works were banned in Germany, and Kurt Weill, whose melodies were like a combination of both opera and jazz. Previously, they had a big hit with a ballad called Mack the Knife that Bobby Darin had made popular. You couldn't call this a play. It was more like a stream of songs by actors who sang. I went there to wait for Susie and was aroused straight away by the raw intensity of the songs. Within a few minutes, I felt like I hadn't slept or tasted food for about 30 hours. I was so into it. The song that made the strongest impression was a show-stopping ballad, A Ship, the Black Freighter. Its real title was Pirate Jenny, but I didn't hear that in the song, so I didn't know what the real title was. It was sung by some vaguely masculine woman, dressed up like a scrubbing lady who performs petty tasks, goes about making up beds in a ratty waterfront hotel. What drew me into the song at first was the line about the ship, the Black Freighter, that comes after every verse. That particular line took me back to the foghorns of ships that I'd heard in my youth, and the grandiosity of the sounds that stuck in my mind. Seemed like they were right on top of us. Duluth, even though it's 2,000 miles from the nearest ocean, was an international seaport. Foghorns sounded like great announcements. The big boats came and went, iron monsters from the deep. Ships to wipe out all spectacles. As a child, slight, introverted, and asthma-stricken, the sound was so loud, so enveloping, I could feel it in my whole body and it made me feel hollow. Something out there could swallow me up. After I heard the song maybe a couple of times, I kind of forgot about the foghorns and got tuned into the point of view of the maid, where she was coming from in the driest, coldest place. The gentlemen who she is making up beds for have no idea of the hostility inside of her, and the ship, the Black Freighter, seems to be a symbol for some messianic thing. It's always getting closer and closer, and maybe now it's even got its damn foot in the door. The old scrubbing lady's eyes light up at the end of the song. The ship is shooting guns from its bow, and the gentlemen are wiping the laughs off their faces. The ship is still turning around in the harbor. The old lady says, "Kill him right now, that'll earn him." What did the gentleman do to deserve such a fate? The song doesn't say. This is a wild song, big medicine in the lyrics. Heavy action spread out. Each phrase comes to you from a 10-foot drop, scuttles across the road, and then another one comes like a punch on the chin. And then there's always the ghost chorus about the black ship that steps in, fences it off, and locks it up tighter than a drum. It's a nasty song, sung by an evil fiend. And when she's done singing, there's not a word to say. Woody had never written a song like that. It wasn't a protest or topical song, and there was no love for people in it. Later, I found myself taking the song apart, trying to find out what made it tick, why it was so effective. It was the form, the free verse association, the structure and disregard for the known certainty of melodic patterns to make it seriously matter, give it its cutting edge. I could see that the type of songs I was leaning towards singing didn't exist, and I began playing with the form, trying to grasp it, trying to make a song that transcended the information in it, the character and plot. Totally influenced by Pirate Jenny, though staying far away from its ideological heart, I began fooling around with things. Took a story out of the Police Gazette, a tawdry incident about a hooker in Cleveland, a minister's daughter called Snow White who killed one of her customers in a grotesque and ugly way. I started that with using the other song as a prototype and piled lines on, short bursts of lines, 5 or 6 freeform verses, and used the first 2 lines of the Frankie and Albert ballad as the chorus. The lines that say, "Frankie was a good girl, everybody knows, paid $100 for Albert's new suit of clothes." I liked the idea of doing it, but the song didn't come off. I was missing something. The alliance between Susie and me didn't turn out exactly to be a holiday in the woods. Eventually, fate flagged it down and it came to a full stop. It had to end. She took one turn in the road and I took the other. We just passed out of each other's lives. But before that, before the fire went out, we stayed together a lot at the West 4th Street apartment. During the summers, there was more than enough stifling heat. The small place was like an oven full of suffocating air that you could just about chew and swallow. In the winter, there was no heat. It was biting cold, and we kept each other warm, snuggled under blankets. Susie was there by my side when I began recording for Columbia Records. What put me there amongst the crowd came about because of John Hammond. John had first seen and heard me at Carolyn Hester's apartment. Carolyn was a Texan guitar-playing singer who I knew and played with around town. She was going places, and it didn't surprise me. Carolyn had asked me to play harmonica on some songs for her debut record on Columbia and to teach her a couple of other things that she had heard me do. I was happy to do that. Hammond had wanted to meet us and get everything in running order, to hear the songs Carolyn was thinking about recording. That's where he first heard me. He heard my harp playing and guitar strumming. Even heard me singing a few things in harmony with Carolyn, but I didn't notice him noticing me. Between that time and the next time I met him, it seemed like a tidal wave had happened, in my world anyway. I'd been playing the most prominent folk club in America, the one called Gertie's Folk City, and was on the bill with a bluegrass band, the Greenbrier Boys, and had been given a rave review in the folk and jazz section of the New York Times. This article appeared the night before Carolyn's recording session, and the next day Hammond saw the newspaper. The sessions went well, and as everyone was packing up and leaving, Hammond asked me to come to the control booth and told me that he'd like me to record for Columbia Records. I said that, yeah, I would like to do that. It felt like my heart leaped up to the sky, to some intergalactic star. Inside, I was in a state of unstable equilibrium, but you wouldn't have known it. I couldn't believe it. It seemed too good to be true. My whole life was about to be derailed. It seemed like eons ago since I'd been in Flo Kastner's brother's apartment in southeast Minneapolis, listening to the Spirituals to Swing album and the Woody Guthrie songs. Now, incredulously, I was sitting in the office of the man responsible for the Spirituals to Swing album, and he was signing me the Columbia Records. John Hammond put a contract down in front of me, the standard one they gave to any new artist. He said, "Do you know what this is?" I looked at the top page, which said, "Columbia Records," and said, "Where do I sign?" Hammond showed me where, and I wrote my name down with a steady hand. I trusted him. Who wouldn't? There were maybe 1,000 kings in the world, and he was one of them. Before leaving that day, he'd given me a couple of records. One of the records was called King of the Delta Blues by a singer named Robert Johnson. I'd never heard of Robert Johnson. Never heard the name. Never seen it on any other compilation of blues records. Hammond said I should listen to it, that this guy could whip anybody. He showed me the artwork, an unusual painting where the painter with the eye stares down from the ceiling into the room and sees this fiercely intense singer and guitar player, looks no more than medium height but with shoulders like an acrobat. What an electrifying cover. I stared at the illustration. Whoever the singer was in the picture, he already had me possessed. Hammond told me that he knew of him from way back, had tried to get him up to New York to perform at the famous Spirituals to Swing concert, but by that time he had discovered that Johnson was gone, had died mysteriously in Mississippi. He'd only recorded about 20 sides, and Columbia Records owned all of them, and was now about to reissue some. John picked out a date on the calendar for me to come back and start recording, what studio to come to and all that, and I felt high as a kite. Took the subway back downtown and raced over to Van Ronk's apartment. Terry let me in. She'd been in the kitchen doing the domestic thing. The small kitchen was a mess. Bread pudding on the stove, stale French bread with crusts on a cutting board, raisins and vanilla and eggs piled up. "I got a record I want to play for Dave," I said as she let me in. Dave was reading the Daily News. In the pages, the American government was blasting away in Nevada, testing nuclear weapons. The Russians were testing nuclear weapons all over their country, too. James Meredith, a black student in Mississippi, was barred from getting into classrooms at the state university. There were bad things in the news. Dave looked up, peering at me over a pair of horn-rimmed glasses. I had the thick acetate of the Robert Johnson record in my hands, and I asked Van Ronk if he'd ever heard of him. Dave said nope, he hadn't, and I put it on the record player so we could listen to it. From the first note, the vibrations from the loudspeaker made my hair stand up. The stabbing sounds from the guitar could almost break a window. When Johnson started singing, he seemed like a guy who could have sprung from the head of Zeus in full armor. I immediately differentiated between him and anyone else I'd ever heard. The songs weren't customary blues songs. They were perfected pieces. Each song contained four or five verses, every couplet intertwined with the next, but in no obvious way. They were so utterly fluid. At first they went by quick, too quick to even get. They jumped all over the place in range and subject matter, short punchy verses that resulted in some panoramic story. Fires of mankind blasting off the surface of this spinning piece of plastic. Kind-hearted woman, traveling Riverside blues, come on in my kitchen. Johnson's voice and guitar were ringing the room and I was mixed up in it. Didn't see how anybody couldn't be. But Dave wasn't. He kept pointing out that this song comes from another song and that song was an exact replica of a different song. Dave thought Johnson was okay, that the guy was powerful, but that it was all derivative. I let Dave go back to his newspaper, said I'd see him later, and put the acetate back in the white cardboard sleeve. The record that didn't grab Dave very much had left me numb, like I'd been hit by a tranquilizer bullet. Later, at my West 4th Street apartment, I put the record on again and listened to it all by myself. Didn't want to play it for anybody else. Over the next few weeks, I listened to it repeatedly, cut after cut, one song after another, sitting staring at the record player. Whenever I did, it felt like a ghost had come into the room, a fearsome apparition. The songs were layered with a startling economy of lines. Johnson masked the presence of more than 20 men. I fixated on every song and wondered how Johnson did it. Songwriting for him was some highly sophisticated business. The composition seemed to come right out of his mouth and not his memory, and I started meditating on the construction of the verses, seeing how different they were from Woody's. Johnson's words made my nerves quiver like piano wires. They were so elemental in meaning and feeling and gave you so much of the inside picture. It's not that you could sort out every moment carefully, because you can't. There are too many missing terms and too much dual existence. Johnson bypasses tedious descriptions that other blues writers would have written whole songs about. There's no guarantee that any of his lines either happened, or said, or even imagined. When he sings about icicles hanging on a tree, it gives me the chills, or about milk turning blue. It made me nauseous, and I wondered how he did that. Everything for Johnson is legitimate prey. There's a fishing song called Dead Shrimp Blues, unlike anything you could expect. A screwed-up fishing song, with red-blooded lines that's way beyond metaphor. I copied Johnson's words down on scraps of paper so I could more closely examine the lyrics and patterns, the construction of his old-style lines and the free association that he used, the sparkling allegories, big-ass truths wrapped in the hard shell of nonsensical abstraction, themes that flew through the air with the greatest of ease. I didn't have any of these dreams or thoughts, but I was going to acquire them. I thought about Johnson a lot, wondered who his audience could have been. It's hard to imagine sharecroppers or plantation field hands at hop joints relating to songs like these. You'd have to wonder if Johnson was playing for an audience that only he could see, one off in the future. "The stuff I got'll bust your brains out," he sings. Johnson is serious, like the scorched earth. There's nothing clownish about him or his lyrics. I wanted to be like that too. Eventually the record came out and it hit all the blues lovers like an explosion. A few researchers got transfixed on him and went looking for his past, whatever was left of it, and a few found it. Johnson recorded in the 30s, and in the 1960s there were still some folks around in the Delta who had known about him, some even who knew him. There'd been a fast-moving story going around that he had sold his soul to the devil at a four-way crossroads at midnight, and that's how he got to be so good. Well, I don't know about that. The ones who knew him told a different tale, and that was that he had hung around some older blues players in rural parts of Mississippi, played harmonica, was rejected as a bothersome kid, that he went off and learned how to play guitar from a farmhand named Ike Zinnerman, a mysterious character not in any of the history books. Those who knew said that Ike showed Robert the rudiments of how to play like just about anybody, and that Johnson did the rest on his own, that he mainly listened to records and got all of his approaches off those records. You can still hear them, the original records, the songs that were prototypes for all of Johnson's songs. This makes more sense. Johnson's even got a song called Phonograph Blues that's an homage to a record player with a rusty needle. John Hammond had told me that he thought Johnson had read Walt Whitman. Maybe he did, but it doesn't clear up anything. I just couldn't imagine how Johnson's mind could go in and out of so many places. He seems to know about everything. He even throws in Confucius-like sayings whenever it suits him. Neither forlorn or hopeless or shackled, nothing hinders him. As great as the greats were, he goes one step further. You can't imagine him singing Washington's a bourgeois town. He wouldn't have noticed, or if he did, it would have been irrelevant. More than 30 years later, I would see Johnson for myself in 8 seconds worth of 8mm film shot in Ruleville, Mississippi, on a brightly lit afternoon street by some Germans in the late 30s. Some people questioned whether it was really him, but slowing the 8 seconds down so it was more like 80 seconds, you can see that it really is Robert Johnson, has to be, couldn't be anyone else. He's playing with huge spider-like hands and they magically move over the strings of his guitar. There's a harp rack with a harmonica around his neck. He looks nothing like a man of stone, no high-strung temperament. He looks almost childlike, an angelic-looking figure, innocent as can be. He's wearing a white linen jumper, coveralls, and an unusual gilded cap, like Little Lord Fauntleroy. He looks nothing like a man with the hellhound on his trail. He looks immune to human dread, and you stare at the image in disbelief. In a few years' time, I'd write and sing songs like It's All Right, Ma, I'm Only Bleeding, Mr. Tambourine Man, Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, Who Killed Davy Moore, Only a Pawn in Their Game, A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, and some others like that. If I hadn't gone to the Theatre de Lis and heard the ballad Pirate Jenny, it might not have dawned on me to write them, that songs like these could be written. In about 1964 and 65, I probably used about 5 or 6 of Robert Johnson's blues song forms too, unconsciously, but more on the lyrical imagery side of things. If I hadn't heard the Robert Johnson record when I did, there probably would have been hundreds of lines of mine that would have been shut down, that I wouldn't have felt free enough or upraised enough to write. Robert Johnson's code of language was nothing like I'd heard before or since. To go with all that, someplace along the line, Susie had also introduced me to the poetry of French symbolist poet Rimbaud. That was a big deal, too. I came across one of his letters called J'ai un autre, which translates into I as someone else. When I read those words, the bells went off. It made perfect sense. I wish someone would have mentioned that to me earlier. It went right along with Johnson's Dark Night of the Soul and Woody's hopped-up union meeting sermons and the Pirate Jenny framework. Everything was in transition, and I was standing in the gateway. Soon I'd step in, heavy loaded, fully alive and revved up. Not quite yet, though. Lou Levy had autonomy at Leeds Music Publishing Company, the same way John Hammond had autonomy at Columbia Records. Neither was a bureaucrat or egomaniac. Each came from an older world, a more ancient order, one with more piss and vinegar. They knew where they belonged, and they had the guts to back up whatever their beliefs were. You didn't want to let them down. Whatever your dreams were, guys like these could make you realize them. Lou shut off his tape machine and switched on some lamps. The songs I was recording for him were so unlike the big swinging ballads that he'd been used to. Night was coming on, amber lights glowing from the windows across the street. The freezing sleet hit the side of the building like steel drums. Out of the window, it looked like diamonds slung onto black velvet. In the adjoining room, I could hear the sound of Lou's secretary's racing feet going to shut tight one of the windows. Lou's company would never publish any of my greatest songs. Al Grossman had seen to that. Grossman was the big-time manager around Greenwich Village. He had seen me around before, but had paid me little mind. After my first record on Columbia had been released, there was a noticeable shift on his part to represent me. I welcomed the opportunity, because Grossman had a stable of clients and was getting all of them work. When he began to represent me, the first thing he wanted to do was get me out of my Columbia Records contract. I thought that this was screwing around. Grossman informed me that I had been under 21 when I signed the contract, therefore I'd been a minor, making the contract null and void, that I should go up to the Columbia offices and talk to John Hammond and tell him that my contract was illegal and that Grossman would be coming up to negotiate another one. Sure, I went up to see Mr. Hammond, but I had no intentions of doing that. Not if I had been offered a fortune would I have done it. Hammond had believed in me and had backed up his belief, had given me my first start on the world stage, and no one, not even Grossman, had anything to do with that. Hammond said that we should straighten this contract situation out right here and now before it becomes a pressing problem, and so we did that. Later, when I told Grossman what I did, he just about went berserk. "What are you talking about?" he said. It wasn't what he expected. Grossman did get me out of my Leeds music contract, though. I felt like that agreement didn't matter and that Lou Levy hadn't really discovered me or could do anything with my songs anyway, at least not the ones I was doing then. I'd only been there as a favor to Hammond anyway. On this deal-breaker, Grossman had given me $1,000, told me to go up and see Lou Levy, give the money to him, and tell him that I wanted to buy my way out of the contract. I did that, and Lou was only too happy to oblige. "Sure, son," he said. He was still smoking that damn cigar. "There's something unique about your songs, but I can't put my finger on it." I gave Lou the $1,000, and he gave me the contract back. My destiny wouldn't be made manifest up here at Leeds Music, but there was no way to know that in these moments while putting down my early songs into a tape recorder. After Lou heard my Guthrie song, he asked me if I ever wrote any songs about baseball players. I told him I hadn't, and he said that there were some players worth writing about. Lou was a baseball fanatic and could give you statistics on different players. I didn't follow baseball that much, but I did know that Roger Maris, who was with the Yankees, was in the process of breaking Babe Ruth's home run record, and that meant something. Maris was from Hibbing, Minnesota, of all places. Of course, I never heard of him there. Nobody did. I was hearing a lot about him now, though, and so was the rest of the land. On some level, I guess I took pride in being from the same town. There were other Minnesotans, too, that I felt akin to. Charles Lindbergh, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Sinclair Lewis. And then there was Eddie Cochran, one of the early rock and roll geniuses. Native sons, adventurers, prophets, writers, and musicians. They were all from the North Country. Each one followed their own vision, didn't care what the pictures showed. Each one of them would have understood what my inarticulate dreams were about. I felt like I was one of them, or all of them put together. The folk music scene had been like a paradise that I had to leave, like Adam had to leave the garden. It was just too perfect. In a few years' time, a shitstorm would be unleashed. Things would begin to burn. Bras, draft cards, American flags, bridges too. Everybody would be dreaming of getting it on. The national psyche would change, and in a lot of ways it would resemble the Night of the Living Dead. The road out would be treacherous, and I didn't know where it would lead, but I followed it anyway. It was a strange world ahead that would unfold, a thunderhead of a world with jagged lightning edges. Many got it wrong and never did get it right. I went straight into it. It was wide open. One thing for sure, not only was it not run by God, but it wasn't run by the devil either.
Chronicles Volume 1 was written by Bob Dylan and read by Sean Penn. It was abridged for audio by George Truitt. The recording engineer was Andy Greenberg at One Union Recording in San Francisco, with editing by Stephen Strassman, Paul Fowley, and Common Mode. The mix engineer was Paul Fowley. Post-production by Stephen Strassman. The associate producer was Sarah Ginsberg. Chronicles Volume 1 was produced and directed by Elisa Shokoff. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Special thanks to Jeff Rosen, Tracy Castagna, Sato Masuzawa, Karen Frillman, Paul Ruest, Rick Bradley, Ed Haber, and John McGleenan.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.